Tonight's reading is from the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The word of the Lord.
Get a lot of little baby Jesus or 8-year-old Jesus or teenage Jesus. The Bible doesn't really linger long on these stages of Jesus's life. And maybe we wouldn't really want to see a lot of pubescent Jesus, hormony, angsty, rolling his eyes Jesus. But in most of the Gospels, we at least get a glimpse of the incarnate God before he's a full-grown man. And there's something nice about that glimpse. Adds to the vulnerable, the fully humanness. But in John's gospel, there's no birth, no baby, no lying across his mother's lap. The gospel of John says, the word, which is Jesus, was in the beginning, like the beginning of everything. Nothing came into being without this light that shines in the darkness. Not the oceans or the birds, not Dick Cheney or Jeff Bezos or Donald Trump. Nothing came into being without the light, and the darkness does not overcome it. I think that seems hopeful, if not always readily apparent. And then the light became flesh. And the first time we meet him, now it's a him, is at his baptism. As a man, with a beard and a mustache. I mean, probably facial hair, we don't know. And I don't really recommend Googling this topic if you have more important things to do. But anyway, we first meet the Word became flesh at his baptism. And then 3 days later, he's at a wedding with his mother, who we also meet here for the first time. It's funny, Russell and I were talking about what this text was for the week, what the text of the week was for at our staff meeting. And I said I was excited because it was Mary. He said, "What's the text?" I said, "It's Mary," which is interesting. I mean, that I would have that perspective, that this is a text about Mary. Because one could make an argument that it's about Jesus, not Mary. But I guess I'm happy to take what I can get when it comes to women playing important roles in our holy texts. And for me, this is a text about Mary. I mean, the writer writes, the mother of Jesus, the mother of Jesus, her woman, his mother, feminine nouns, pronouns, 6 times in 12 verses. That's a lot of feminine for a chapter in the Bible. I'm sorry to say, but it's true. We don't get a ton of mother, sister, she, her in the Bible. There's far more father, brother, him, his. I think that this makes the women passages stand out from everything else, makes you pay attention. And this is a big text. It's made a lot of, it's made much of, because it's Jesus' first sign in the Gospel of John, and the signs are really important in this book. There will be 7 signs altogether. 7's an important number. But don't start gloomily that either. I think it's significant that the first of these signs isn't instigated by Jesus, but by his mother. It doesn't seem like it's really Jesus' idea to perform this sign. He does it because his mom tells him to. Jesus and his mom are standing around at this wedding when the wine runs out. Mary says, "They have no wine." This would have been a shocking thing, a very big deal. It would have been totally and completely, socially, symbolically, practically morally unacceptable to have a wedding where the wine runs out. You know, I've been to weddings where it's a little bit disappointing that there's a very limited amount of wine. But in first century Palestine, it would have been seriously shameful, a terrible omen for the couple. They have no wine. When the writers of Scripture try to express what hope is, or what it will be like when all will be well, all manner of things will be well, they imagine enormous amounts of good wine. When hope is fulfilled, Amos says, the mountains will drip with good wine and all the hills will flow with wine. Isaiah imagines the consummation of God's kingdom as God making a feast for all people, a feast of well-aged wines. According to the ancient rabbis, without wine, there is no joy. So when Mary says, they have no wine, it's not like an offhanded observation. It's like a very concise expression of existential hopelessness. They have no wine. There's no joy, no hope, or at least not enough to get through the day. There's not enough. They've run out of it. Seems like a potentially very real, very terrible truth. There isn't enough. Scripture isn't a thing that is just about like narrating actual individual events. It's about existential reality, truth, that reaches across time and space into the depths and heights of the human condition, the life of creation, God. And it seems true often that there's not enough. Food, hope, healing, kindness, warmth, light, clean water. There's not enough love, not enough human empathy to keep teenage boys from mocking a beautiful old Native American man. There's not enough wine, Mary says, at a wedding. And wedding imagery is as important in the Bible as wine imagery. It's all over. God's relationship to the land, marriage. God is married to Israel. There's the marriage of the Lamb and the bride of Christ. The church's relationship to Jesus is imaged as marriage. The image suggests intimacy, union, with a lover that you can count on to be with you through all of life and its banal and terrible and beautiful moments. So this scene includes 2 super important biblical images. It's not like la-di-da, Jesus happens to go to a wedding and the wine happens to run out. It's like big, flashing, potent symbolism here. Marriage and wine. It's almost like Jesus and his mom are in the middle of some supercharged metaphor tornado that is also grounded in a couple and a meal, real people and real life. Mary seems to recognize it all, have no wine, she says. She doesn't make a big production. I feel like she says this kind of cool, under her breath, just to her son. Not in this way that's going to get everyone's attention. But she recognized that there is a situation here that needs attention. Jesus? I mean, his mom recognizes the situation is nearing familial crisis. And he's like, what does that have to do with me and you? Why should this concern us? Like, are we involved in this? No. I don't think this reflects a very flattering light on him. Seems sort of, for lack of a better term, I readily admit, male. As if this shattering embarrassment, this pain of other people is not his concern. Thank God for Mary. God knows we need her. And Jesus did too, obviously. Like, to give birth to him and nurse him and be a good parent to him, teach him. He says, woman, what concern is that to you and me? In other translations, woman, what do you have to do with me? If I were his mother, I think that might make me lose my composure. He doesn't think the needs of other people are any concern to him. He is disrespectful to his mother. But it's like Mary doesn't even quite regard this version of him. I mean, I guess, I don't know, maybe she rolls her eyes and huffs and looks at him like, what is wrong with you? But it seems she's more like overlooking his resistance. Like she knows, she doesn't question for a minute that this is his concern. And by trusting this loving, graceful, merciful version of her son, she helps to call that into being. I mean, love your neighbor as yourself will become the core of everything he says and does. Other people's palpable, material, immediate, physical, emotional needs? He's like, how does this concern us? Mary ignores his distancing, and she sets this first sign in motion. She tells the people helping with the wedding to do whatever he says. Like, he might not have completely grown into himself yet, but she knows he can do something, and she sees that he does it. The servants take the direction from Mary. Some Protestant interpreters, put off by Catholic reverence of Mary, use this passage as evidence that Mary isn't really worthy of veneration. Like, she was wrong somehow. Like, she was too concerned with these ordinary things. But geez, if you ask me, hey, Mary, full of grace, don't we need help with the ordinary things? Mary thinks Jesus should help these people, and perhaps on the more metaphorical level, help overcome the existential human dread that there is not enough. It's no wonder that people in need often turn to Mary. It's no wonder that she keeps showing up through history, across cultures, for people in need in Medjugorje, Fatima, Lourdes, Poland, Rwanda, Egypt, China, Mexico, Wisconsin. In so many ways and places, people find her in toast, lumps of firewood, chapatis, tortillas, and a grilled cheese sandwich. Never mind if the powerful and the educated dismiss her. She comes for the sick and the wounded and the oppressed. She comes to comfort the poor. I mean, who in their desperation wants to hear from a young man, of what concern is that to me? But Jesus does act at the behest of his mother. I'm guessing that she never stops helping him to be more who he is. And then I like what he does. It's pretty wild. It's very cool. But also kind of extra. Took me a while to understand this new expression that the kids are using. Olivia came home from a speech meet or something when she was in high school, unhappy because someone said she was so extra. I couldn't understand what was wrong with that. Extra special, extra smart, extra great, extra awesome. But I understand it now. I understand how it's not meant as a compliment. And I think maybe Jesus' miracle here is kind of extra. I mean, if this weren't scripture and Jesus wasn't God incarnate, I might even think what he does next is a sort of raising of the middle finger to his mom. Like, you want me to do something? Okay, mom, fine. And he goes so over the top. It's a little obnoxious. And maybe there's room for that in scripture. In a God who becomes flesh, fully human, tangles with his mother, screws up, learns, grows into grace. The wine runs out. His mother expects him to do something. So the life and the light of the world looks around, locates these containers that hold water, the water that guests use to wash their hands. And Jesus fills them with excellent wine. There are 6 containers, and they're huge. They hold like 20 or 30 gallons. That's like 1,000 bottles of wine. Seems so extra. He fills the containers that were meant to hold water that people used to clean up before dinner with wine. I mean, it seems kind of beautiful, but it also has a little bit of an edge, like impolite. How are the people going to wash their hands? Washing hands is important. You need water to do it. And Jesus turns the water into wine. I mean, are people grateful? Or are they a little bit like, what the hell? It's like a beautiful move. He makes the wine, the joy, the hope. He averts the potential existential disaster. But it might have been a little bit hard to recognize completely. Because it also definitely messed with things. He doesn't exactly overthrow the rules and means of polite society or blow them all up. He fills the containers that held the water for purifying with something delightful, wine. But the act certainly would give rise to some questions. People are sometimes worried about reading this as if Jesus is offensive here. It's not Jesus being offensive, they say. It's about generosity, excessive abundance. But maybe that is occasionally offensive. Excess can be offensive. Excessive wine? For sure. To what sort of anarchy might that lead? Jesus makes sure there is enough, way more than enough, but I wonder if people's reactions to this were a little bit mixed. I mean, do you want a lot of really drunk people at your wedding? I bet there were some people that didn't even want to drink that wine, that would have been happier to have the water, so that they could wash their hands. But maybe that's a little bit what grace is like sometimes. Like, say you live under the reign of an oppressive regime, for example. And so instead of doing what you're supposed to do, staying in line, washing your hands, following the rules, you follow, say, the love, the excessive, never-ending, all-encompassing mercy. I think maybe that could lead to some upsetting things. Like, it might upset things, upset life as usual. It might be that the sheer excess of the life and the love and the mercy of God could be a little bit much for us. So maybe we don't always choose to drink it. Maybe the good wine is always there for the drinking, but we're a little bit afraid of what drinking it might mean. Loving our neighbors as ourselves. Loving our enemies. Serving God instead of mammon. Jesus seems maybe a little bit aloof before he enacts this first sign. But his mother trusts him to do something about the situation, to do something about this archetypal anxiety that there is not enough. And then his next sign, he'll heal a little boy who's at the point of death. And then he'll help a man walk. And then his fourth sign will be feeding 5,000 people from one loaf of bread. The light grows, and it collides with the conventional order, collides with the systems that run the world. We mostly live subservient to the conventional order, to the systems that run the world, even though they are racist. Even though they favor the rich, even though they threaten the life of the planet. Like living any other way seems impossible. To be free from dependence on fossil fuels, it doesn't seem realistic. The final sign Jesus performs in this book is to raise Lazarus from the dead. I don't think it's a sign that Jesus will bring your loved ones back to life before your eyes. But it says a lot about how much life there is in the light of the world. How it can't be defeated by all the bounds that we usually believe in. This passage is often used in traditional wedding liturgies to bless the couple getting married. The minister prays to God, "As you gladden the wedding in Cana of Galilee by the presence of your son, now bring your joy to this wedding." Thinking about this, it seems like kind of a risky thing to ask. I mean, this joy, what is that going to be like? Surely bursting the bounds of convention, like watch out. It's like inviting the God of excessive life and love, institution bursting, infinite, boundary-breaking, uncontainable mercy to crash your little ceremony, your little ritual. I think that's what we do here, too, with our little ritual. We drink that wine, the excessive love and mercy, and it might be a little traumatic, extra much. To drink the death of death, and thus the sheer excess of life. So maybe that's why we have just a little bit.